Our text this morning is from the book of Exodus. Take a moment then to reflect with me as we begin the journey. Eternal God, as your word is resting on our heart at this moment, may you prepare our hearts and our mind and our soul. Thank you for the work that you have done with Winston this week, and perhaps in the years before, as he engages with us in the word that he will present and that we will read in a moment. Thank you, Jesus. Amen. At midnight, the Lord struck down all the firstborn in Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sat on the throne to the firstborn of the prisoner who was in the dungeon, and the firstborn of all the livestock as well. Pharaoh and all his officials and all the Egyptians got up during the night, and there was a loud wailing in Egypt, for there was not a house without someone dead. During the night, Pharaoh summoned Moses and Aaron and said, "Up, leave my people, you and the Israelites. Go, worship the Lord as you have requested. Take your flocks and herds as you have said, and go. And also bless me." The Israelites did as Moses instructed and asked the Egyptians for articles of silver and gold and for clothing. The Lord had made the Egyptians favorable disposed toward the people, and they gave them what they asked for, so they plundered the Egyptians. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Tell the Israelites to turn back and encamp near Pi Hahiroth, between Migdol and the sea. They are to camp by the sea directly opposite Baal Zephon. Pharaoh will think the Israelites are wandering around the land in confusion, hemmed in by the desert. And I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will pursue them. But I will gain glory for myself through Pharaoh and all his army, and the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord." So the Israelites did this. As Pharaoh approached, the Israelites looked up, and there were the Egyptians marching after them. They were terrified and cried out to the Lord. They said to Moses, "Was it because there were no graves in Egypt that you brought us to the desert to die? What have you done to us by bringing us out of Egypt? Didn't we say to you in Egypt, 'Leave us alone, let us serve the Egyptians'? It would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the desert." Moses answered the people, "Do not be afraid. Stand firm, and you will see the deliverance the Lord will bring you today. The Egyptians you see today, you will never see again. The Lord will fight for you. You need only to be still."
Good morning, people of peace. Boom! This is it. Game on. There is no bigger event in all of the Old Testament than this. Moses is beginning to lead God's people out of Egypt. In actual fact, there's no bigger event in all of the Bible except for one. There's only one other event that tops this one, and that is the life, the death, and the resurrection of the Lord Jesus. This is one of those great signal events in all of the Bible. Moses here beginning to lead God's people out of Egypt. But very interesting, as David mentioned from last week, what a different Moses we see. Isn't it a different Moses? Not the same Moses that we encountered last week. So much has happened in between. The story has been building to a crescendo from where we left off last week. Last week, we were at the scene where Moses is speaking to God and the Lord is giving him this commission. And Moses is basically trying to weasel his way out of doing God's will. You remember that. And here we've got this picture of Moses today leading God's people out confidently, a beautiful picture. And we are told by Bible scholars that anywhere between 4 to possibly 8 to 9 months have passed in between. And what's happened in this particular period? Well, we've had that matter of the 10 plagues. Moses has asked the Pharaoh repeatedly, let God's people go. And repeatedly, Pharaoh has said a flat no. And so what has God done? God has sent to Pharaoh escalating plagues to convince him of God's superior power. And at first, as the plagues got tougher, Pharaoh would appear to concede, and then he'd gather his resolve again, harden his heart, and he would refuse, and he would say no. So we discover that Pharaoh is actually quite a tough nut. He really, really is. And the Lord has to work hard to crack him and has to send 10 tough plagues to convince him. And the 10th plague is the harshest of all. All the firstborn in Egypt are killed. And in so doing, God proves to Pharaoh and God proves to the Egyptians God's power over life and death. But God also proves something else to them, very, very important, because this is just not a story about the power of God over life and death. This is a story about the battle between God and the other evil spiritual powers. So God is demonstrating to Pharaoh and to the Egyptians his ability to penetrate beyond their perceived superior spiritual power and defenses. In other words, what the Lord is doing here, he's saying that you believe that you've got the spiritual power and the spiritual power over not just the Israelites, but over all the world, and I'm able to get right through those spiritual defenses, get behind that enemy line, and strike a blow. That's what's going on in this picture. In other words, the Lord is saying, your spiritual powers mean nothing to me. They offer you no power, and they offer you no defense at all, Pharaoh. So there's a lot going on here. But friends, it is a brutal picture. It is a very, very brutal picture. And as we consider it, we need to remember that it need not have been so brutal. It need not have been so brutal. And as we read the story, I want to offer us, well, out there today, there are right ways to read the story and there are wrong ways to read the story. And I'm going to start off by sharing maybe just quickly two wrong ways first, but then I'll offer what I believe is a better way to be able to read the story. And the first wrong way is the one of many, many skeptics. And you've probably heard this out there today. I don't want to serve that particular God because God is a God of wrath. A God who is harsh and a God who is vindictive and a God who always seems to be angry. I don't want to serve a God like that. That's the God of the Old Testament. If that is your God, I don't want any part of that. So there's the skeptic. God is always wrathful. But sometimes even we as believers have struggled a little bit with this and we've offered up various ways to explain it. I think one unhelpful way is to say that, well, between the Old Testament and the New Testament, we've got two different dispensations. Now, in a sense, there is some merit to that. But behind that, what people are saying is that, well, God in the Old Testament was all about wrath. And by the time we come to the New Testament, God seems to flick the switch inside of him and suddenly becomes a God of grace and a God of mercy. So the Old Testament pictures this picture of a God of wrath, but the New Testament depicts this wonderful picture of a God of mercy and a God of grace. But friends, that's wrong. That's wrong because if you read the Old Testament, there's an enormous amount of grace there. God rescuing his people, isn't that an act of grace? So the Old Testament is dripping with grace, my friends. The Old Testament is dripping with grace. But the New Testament at the same time is very easy for us to say because Jesus has come and we've got this beautiful picture of the love of God that there is no wrath or there's no consequence to sin there. But you don't find that in the New Testament. There are enough passages in the New Testament to make you feel just a little bit uncomfortable in case you tend to think that God is only this God of love, but there's no wrath there for evil. So that gets knocked down. So that sense that we have this different dispensation and God switches something within his nature is almost as though God changes within himself. That is wrong. But I believe that there is a better way to explain this. And the better way is to see God's extraordinary patience. God's extraordinary patience. We encountered this last week, not just with Pharaoh. Let's actually just go back. Let's see God's extraordinary patience with Moses. We discovered last week that the Lord only became angry toward him at his fifth refusal. And then the Lord still offers to send him some help anyway. So there we have Moses last week giving five reasons, five excuses for not doing God's will. And the Lord only displays his anger towards Moses the fifth time. We're not told what that anger was, but somehow Moses felt that, okay, now I'm pushing it. It's almost like a kid with a parent. You know, when your mom or your dad, suddenly the tone of their voice changes. And it moves from just being Adam to Adam. Okay? And then you know, I'm sure Moses must have sensed that, okay, I'm pushing it now. Okay? But it took him five times before God did that. So there's a sign of grace, my friends. That's grace. Because this is God speaking to you. So you should answer the right way the first time. So if that isn't grace, but this is with one whom the Lord has called. And here we have Pharaoh. At this particular point, the Lord has given him 10 calls and sent 9 plagues. And there's been still no change in his heart. It's almost like God is saying, with one of my children, I'll do it 5 times. But with those who are set against me, I'll even give them greater grace. I'll do it even more. I'll give them 10 times in order to change. But there's no change in Pharaoh's heart at all. No change. He only agrees on the 10th one when God has had to strike a severe blow and God has had to sever the line of succession of his sacred dynasty. Because Pharaoh, it was believed, had descended from the gods, and he was this descendant of the gods, and his family would be this family, this line, the sacred line who would rule over Egypt and rule over the world by this divine commission that they had. And the Lord severs that line. Very powerful display of who is sovereign. But it only comes on the 10th occasion. So I want us, friends, to see that there's real grace here. Not just grace in the Lord coming to rescue his people, but we see grace in the Lord's extraordinary patience. So don't let people tell you that the Old Testament is just about wrath and anger and law. The Old Testament is also about grace, and we see God's grace. But it's also a very, very stark warning to us, and that is eventually there is a cost to stubborn, willful rebellion. God is patient, extraordinarily patient, but God will not allow us to trifle with him all the time. So there's that warning in the passage, and it's there. Pharaoh gets it, but it's also there as a warning to us. But here we are. The people of God are beginning their march on the way out, and they hardly believe what they've come to hear. These words that they never thought they would hear, they finally hear from Pharaoh. These great words, up, leave, and go. In other words, take your stuff and scram, get out of here. And then Pharaoh says something very, very interesting. Did you pick it up there? He says, and bless me also. Okay, so Pharaoh knows who he's dealing with. And he knows that this God is greater than any of the powers that he believes in. And this God has struck him a really tough blow. And he says to Moses, up, leave and go, but bless me also. And it's interesting to see the response of the other Egyptians, their hard taskmasters. Here they tell the Israelites, here, take everything, take our gold and take our silver and take our clothing. It says that the Lord changed their heart to make them more favorable towards the Israelites. And they actually said, take our stuff as you leave. And you have that wonderful line, and the Egyptians and the Israelites plundered the Egyptians. All amazing. They never thought that this would happen. And you can almost see the people of Israel, in a sense, almost reveling in the scene. We're told that they packed quickly and they moved, but they didn't run like scared cats. You get the sense that they sort of strutted out triumphantly, collecting spoil on the way out. It must have felt so good to be able to walk out and say to your taskmasters and these hard madams and masters whom you've had to serve, I'll take that stuff from you, thank you, and I'm leaving right now. And they are giving it to you willfully, and there's a sense of fear and dread that has come over them. So, my friends, we see here a picture of something which we know in our heart, and that is when justice is delivered, it always feels sweet, doesn't it? There's something sweet about justice. And here you get the sense of them walking out confidently as the Lord has opened up this opportunity for them to be rescued. And so they walk out and they march out and they collect spoil on their way out. And as they walk straight from Egypt right into the promised land. And it's the end of the story, and what a wonderful way to conclude it. Nope, it doesn't end there. What happens? It says, God turned them back. Don't like that line. I don't like that line in there. I kind of want the Lord just to lead us to the promised land with no issues along the way, but it actually says that God turned them back and God sent them along the path by the desert toward the sea, right opposite a place which is called Baal Zephon. And Baal is the name for God in the Old Testament. And Zephon, we discover, is the god of the storm, is the god of the weather. And remember, Egypt is a country that depends on the Nile. So the god of the storm is also, in a sense, the giver of life. Because if water doesn't flow from the Nile, there's no life there. And so the Lord leads them right opposite to the sacred site for them, opposite the site of this god who they see has been one of the great gods in the pantheon. And the Lord leads them right there between the sacred site and the sea and the desert in between. Literally, the Lord leads them between the devil and the deep blue sea. That's where they are. Between this force of evil, the deep blue sea, and the approaching Egyptian army. Fear and terror. So how do the people of Israel, the people of God, respond to this particular challenge that the Lord sends them? They respond terribly. Terribly. And it's so easy for us to judge them. But as we go through this, just see and think to yourself, how would you have responded, my friends? Because it's so easy to sit and it looks like a very, very nice story, but this was their real experience. Egypt was the most powerful nation on earth. Pharaoh was the strongest ruler on earth. There was no other army greater than them. And here the Israelites find themselves between the Red Sea on the one side, between the sacred site, stuck in the desert, and the approaching Egyptian army. It's an existential fear. It's a real fear of dread. I may not survive this. We may not survive this. So what happens? Well, you've seen this before, but I know when I did that series on change, we dealt with something similar, but this is the first time it happens. We have here the first of many meltdowns. And the meltdown looks pretty much the same every time. So let's go through that anatomy of this meltdown quickly. First one is, what happens when people face this existential fear and their faith fails them? Often you get biting sarcasm. Biting sarcasm. I mean, I love that line. Were there no graves in Egypt that you brought us here to die? My goodness, at least if we died in Egypt, we'd be buried. Over here, we're just going to lie out in the desert. So were there no graves? I mean, that is super, super sarcastic. Okay? And they move on. The next thing that we often see when people have a meltdown, people tend to turn on their leaders. Turn on their leaders. What do they ask Moses? What have you done to us? So this is Moses' fault. Moses is the one who forced them. And they say to him, did we not tell you to leave us alone? Didn't we not tell you to leave us alone? What have you done to us? So they turn on their leaders. And then, and I apologize for the word, but this is the only way I can describe it. What follows next is nothing other than stupid thinking. And I have to call it stupid thinking because it is stupid thinking. They actually start reasoning in this crazy way where they're saying, we were better off as slaves in Egypt. And I love the line that Bob Marley uses in his great song, that song called Redemption Song. Do you remember the line? Emancipate yourselves from mental slavery. It's a great line. Lots of truth in that line. Because yeah, the Lord has freed them now from physical slavery, but we discover that they are still slaves in their minds. They need to be emancipated from mental slavery. We were better off as slaves in Egypt. At least we knew what to expect. Crazy thinking. Stupid thinking. But my friends, when we are facing a fear, we often think like that. What we know seems far better than the unknown. And we have a situation here where for them, freedom actually becomes frightening. They'd been longing for it their entire lives, and here it's starting to happen, and they're facing the first challenge to that freedom, and they become frightened. And the prospect of slavery, which they knew, and it's the only thing that they've known for 400 years, appears better because they know what to expect. An important lesson for all of us in our spiritual lives, my friends. Fear of the unknown, which causes us to act in these anxious ways, but also the quest for certainty those two on their own, and especially those two together, the fear of the unknown and that quest for certainty, they breed unbelief. They breed unbelief. We live in a world where people are gripped by being able to control everything. And we get technologies, and nothing wrong with technology. I'm a techie guy. I like that. But it gives us the sense that we can control all things in life. We can't, friends. We can't. And as people of faith, we need to keep that in mind always, that the Lord is leading us along a path that He knows the end, but He doesn't often tell us what that path is. So the fear of the unknown and that quest for certainty can breed unbelief if we let it take root in our hearts. Very, very important challenge. And it also begs the question, why does the Lord do this? The Lord frees them and then He leads them back into the wilderness. Why does the Lord do this? I believe for at least three reasons. One, the Lord does it to test us. To test us. Why? To expose the quality of our faith, or in this case, the lack thereof. The Lord does it to train us. Train us how? That as we go through these trials repeatedly over and over and over again, hopefully we learn to trust in Him and we grow in our faith despite the appearance of our circumstances. And some of you know that. You've been whacked with one challenge after the next, but hopefully you're able to look back and say, my faith has grown. My faith has grown. And we discover that the Lord is the one who led them there. The Lord is the one who sent them back into the wilderness. The Lord is the one who tests them. Where do we encounter the story again in the New Testament? Jesus. Right after Jesus has been baptized and the Spirit of God has descended upon Jesus like a dove, filled Him with power, where does the Spirit of God lead Jesus to? The wilderness. 40 days in the wilderness. So the Lord is the one who led them there, but the Lord tells us why He led them there. So that the glory in the end will go to Him. When the Lord leads us into those situations where we are way beyond our own power, and we know that we are weak and we can only but call out to Him for help, and then there is the sense of this miraculous breakthrough and this miraculous deliverance, when that happens, the glory can only go one way, to God. We don't get to claim the credit for ourselves, even though often with hindsight we do. You know, I did and I engineered. But the Lord puts them in a situation where there is absolutely no way that they can claim any of that credit for themselves. The glory will go to Him. But friends, I want us to step back today and have a look at Moses. Wow, don't you feel proud of him? This is a different Moses to the Moses that we saw last week. And we need to ask ourselves, what's happened? What's brought about this change? And so what I'd like to do is I'd like to do a little bit of a compare and a contrast. So we saw Moses raise five objections with the Lord last week. Who am I? I can't do that. And on whose authority will I be acting? And they won't listen to me. And I'm not a powerful speaker. And then his last one is basically just, I don't want to do it. So he raises these five objections, and let's compare and contrast now. So that was the Moses that we saw last week, but this is a totally different Moses now. That first objection was, who am I? I can never do that. And here we have Moses confidently leading God's people out. The second objection, on whose authority? Who sent me? How are they going to believe that I'm sent by you? And God says they will. And we discover in the story that it's clear to people who's the God that's acting and who's the God that's in control. But we discover that it's not only clear to Moses and to the Israelites, it's also clear to Pharaoh. Because what does he say? He says to Moses, go and worship the Lord Yahweh as requested. So Pharaoh knows who's the one who's acting behind Moses, the one for whom Moses is the agent. Very, very clear. No doubt as to which God is the God that's acting here. So whose authority? Very, very clear whose authority Moses is acting on. And they won't listen to me. And we discover the story says that the people actually followed Moses' instructions. God had changed the Israelites' hearts to listen to him. And so they pack up and they march out and they plunder at Moses' instruction. So that very thing that he thought wouldn't happen, that I don't have the credibility, he discovers that God changes the hearts of the people toward him. But the other one is, and the one that I like, is he says, but Lord, I'm not a powerful speaker. Not entirely true. Because we discover here Moses speaking to the people with real poise and confidence. What does he say to them? He says, do not be afraid, stand firm. And as their hearts begin to melt, he admonishes them with authority and he says, be quiet and watch. And we are told by Hebrew scholars that in the English, they've softened that to make it quite nice. The actual Hebrew is pretty blunt. It's basically, be still and watch. In other words, shut up and see what's going to happen. Keep your hearts together. Something great is about to take place right now. All that the Lord requires of you to do is to zip your lips and watch. See my glory. Here we have a Moses who said he wasn't a confident, competent speaker, standing up before the people of God, leading them forcefully, challenging them in terms of their faith that is melting. And the last one where he said, send someone else. And he basically dragged himself along to do what the Lord had commanded. We see now a different Moses, somebody who has embraced God's call and embraced God's commission for his life. A very, very different Moses. But friends, that different picture of Moses is meant to be a picture of hope for us. It's not just meant for us to admire Moses from afar, but it's for us to be able to look at this picture and say, we can grow like that. We can grow like that. So Moses is being held up, not just as a great picture, but he's also being held up as a great model and a great example. And so we've got to ask ourselves, well, how did he get there? And then how will I get there? Well, we discover that Moses got there by having to face a number of tough tests. He faced a whole lot of tough tests in Egypt. Each plague, my friends, was not only a test of Pharaoh's heart, but each plague was also a test of Moses' faith and character too. Because if God didn't deliver on just one of those, his credibility is shot, the people's confidence in him is gone, and his trust in God is shaken. So each and every single one of those tests was not just a test of Pharaoh's heart, but it was a test of Moses' faith and character too. And we discover that with each test, as Pharaoh's heart grows harder, Moses' heart grows stronger. And my iPad has just switched off. Right there. Give me a second. Bad timing. So, there we go, finding my way. So Moses' heart is growing stronger, and we have this sense that he is being built up by God, but God is trying him through these tests. But it forces us, friends, it forces us to face a very hard reality in life. And that hard reality is that the Lord tests us. I wish that wasn't true. I really do wish that that wasn't true, that the journey of faith was always easy, was the smooth path along a level highway. But it doesn't work that way. And here's an insight that I'd like to leave with you today, and that is that the road to maturity and to eventual victory in the life of faith is paved with tests and trials. We know that, but sometimes it's hard to accept that when you find yourself in the midst of that challenge. And there's this quote which one of the scholars that I was reading in preparation for this said that I thought was absolutely great. And he's putting this out there as a reminder, not just an insight, but a reminder to us as the people of God. And he says this, our circumstances are not the final standard with which to view the work of God. It's so easy for us to live just by what we see. But our circumstances, friend, the things that are happening to us are not the final standard with which to view the work of God. There's a greater reality behind that. And so we can't end there. We've got to ask one more question. What made all the difference? Not just how did he get there? What made all the difference? And the answer simply is God. God. Trust and obey. God called. Moses trusted reluctantly, and he followed half-heartedly in the beginning, but his faith has grown as he's learned to trust the Lord. The difference in his life with this particular call is none other than God himself. Because even though Moses is being offered up to us as a real hero and as a real model, the real hero of the story is God. He is the one who will get the glory. And so what do we learn about God? Not only what do we learn from Moses, but very, very importantly for us as believers today, what do we learn about God from this story? Well, firstly, very importantly, we discover God's sovereign power. Never lose sight of that. God's power to compel Pharaoh to free them. God's sovereign power to be able to change the Egyptians' hearts, to show favor to them and to give them stuff. But God's ability also to change the people of God's hearts to listen to Moses. And that's something which we really, really, as God's people, need to bear in mind. And we often hold on to that last one, and we know that in our hearts, that God is able to change our hearts. But sometimes we think that God is not able to change the hearts of those who are set against us and those who are set against him. Never forget that, my friends, that God is able to change your heart, but God is also able to change the heart of those who set themselves against him, of those who are in opposition to you and in opposition to God. Remember that always. God's sovereign power. Also God's faithfulness. God delivers on his promise to the people to rescue them from the grip of slavery and to Moses to be with him every single step of the way. So that's the second one. And the third one, never forget God's inscrutable ways. And what do I mean by that? That God molds our character and refines our faith the old-fashioned way. Hard tests, tough trials, and yep, even wilderness wandering experiences. God molds our characters and God refines our faith that way. Right at the beginning, Moses believed that Pharaoh won't budge. He did. The people saw this approaching army, and what did they see? They were overcome by this existential threat. They thought that they'd either starve there in the wilderness, they'd either drown in the Red Sea, or they would face certain slaughter as the Egyptian army approached. Little did they know that within a couple of moments, or maybe within a couple of hours, they would soon pass right through that Red Sea. That's what awaited them. So God's inscrutable ways, the Lord knows the way he's going to lead us. We don't know. We often get marching orders just one step at a time, but we've got to take those steps as they come. And then there's God's glory. As the Lord says, I will gain glory for myself. We discover the same thing in the New Testament. Heidi has chosen an interesting verse on the front of the bulletin today, and I was thinking of the passage that we preached, or I preached on, for Lincoln's funeral, where it says this: we have this treasure in jars of clay. But why do we have this treasure in jars of clay? Paul goes on to say, to be clear that this extraordinary power belongs to God. So not just our lips, but our lives and the way in which we live and the power that we display, the glory goes to God. His power is displayed even in our weakness. So, my friends, would you love to have a faith like Moses? I certainly would. I often feel more like Moses when the Lord first encounters him. And I think that's a very funny encounter, because when the Lord first encounters him at the burning bush, he is filled with reverence and fear. And we're told that he's filled with reverence and fear. But the Lord invites him in, and then he soon gains his composure. Okay, and once he's overcome the fear thing, the old rebellious spirit begins to rear its head again. And he feels comfortable to be able to say no and to find excuses and to find ways to weasel out. I often feel like that. But my friends, we can grow, and not all of us are going to lead the people of God out of slavery into the promised land. But we've all got a role to play in God's plan. We all have. God has a call on each and every single one of our lives. He does. And he's calling us forward to follow him in faith. And as I often say from up here, I don't know as I stand here what that call is in your life. Some of you graduating school. Some of you graduating college. Some of you at the other end of that, retiring. That doesn't mean it's over. That doesn't mean it's over. That doesn't mean that God doesn't have a next plan for your life. My friends, doesn't mean that at all. But like Moses, we got to get from that place of fear to this place of confidence by trusting God and facing those tough challenges along the way. So therefore, friends, I want to end with this. When God calls, and the task is huge, and we feel out of our depths, and our hearts begin to fail us, remember what made all the difference, and remember how Moses got to this point. First, by answering God's call. He wouldn't have got here if he'd stepped away and just kept walking at that burning bush. By answering God's call, but also stepping forward further and trusting God's promise. God's promise to lead him, God's promise to protect him, God's promise to always be with him. That same promise is the promise that Jesus made to you. Jesus promised to lead us, to protect us, and to always be with us. And lo, I will be with you always, even until the end of the age. That is the promise that we have as we step out in faith and follow God's call. Will you step forward? That is God's call on your heart. All the people of God say, Amen.